chore for Ashley, if you want.
The enforcement of this will be as an unfair labor practice, and the Bureau of Labor and Industries would enforce it uniformly. Section 8.
Chair, just a drafting question on Section 7. You talk about the identity of the employee who discloses information which the employee reasonably believes shows any of the following, and then you go to the following, and they all have within them a reasonable belief by the employee standard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if it's necessary to have it twice. In other words, whether we shouldn't simply say the identity of the employee who discloses any of the following shall not be disclosed.
That's probably true.
Because
a reasonable belief
is built into each of those standards. I just checked it.
Yeah. Okay, that's correct. Why don't we correct that, Mr. Chairman? I have no objection.
Okay, discloses information. Discloses any of the following. Shall not be disclosed.
I think that does it.
Yep. Any of the following information.
Any of the following.
Discloses any of the following.
Okay. Who discloses any of the following shall not be disclosed without the written consent.
Okay, that's fine.
It's matters described in those subparagraphs and reports required.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chairman, Section 8 is existing law. We're changing it a little bit. We're rearranging it so that we're making sure we hold.
Where is Section 8?
It's on page 3.
Oh, there it is.
Line
okay.
28.
Yep.
It is an unlawful employment practice for an employer, that's current law, to do a number of things there. And we're striking the new language. Our intent here is to hold that language harmless. That applies to all employers, including private employers. We don't want to mess with private employers. So the intent here is to hold private employers harmless. And instead add B, add the semicolon or sub B, a public employer is defined as Section 2 of this 1989 Act to violate Sections 3 to 5 and 7 of this 1989 Act. So that's the new language we're adding. And that is that would make it an unfair labor employment practice for the public employer to violate this act, the effective parts of this act. Okay, and then we've got Section 9.
Well, I'm sorry, what was the reference to Section 7 that you just made? I don't see it on the
Section 7 is the section that
protects. No, I know what it is, but identity. You were referring to it when you were discussing this.
Okay, it's on line 34B.
Yeah,
Section 3 to 5 and 7. Where's 7?
Okay, are you operating? You've got the wrong version. Are you operating off the 421 version?
No, okay, pardon me. Glad I asked.
There we go.
There aren't very many differences.
There is one.
Is that it?
All we know.
Okay.
I'll point out the ones.
Mr. Chairman, and Section 9 is new language. It's an existing statute. It allows the executive. Pardon?
Deleting that.
All we're doing is deleting.
We're deleting. We're deleting old language that we're superseding.
That's the unenforceable, vague stuff we're operating under.
Yeah, under which they've never had a complaint.
Nobody's ever got a complaint and it never worked.
For good reason. And then Section 10 is the repealer of 740. That's the Section 7 change.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the emergency clause.
Question. Give me a couple of for instances here. I work for the city of Portland. Let's make it a legislature. Well, let's use ourselves. Okay. I work for the state of Oregon, and policy decisions are being discussed and options are being considered, and I come to a legislator and I cough all this up, documentation, et cetera, and so forth. Under section
Section 3?
Section 3 of the bill.
Or is Can I ask a question here? Are we assuming that there's something fishy going on, or?
No, this is just everyday, ordinary kind of stuff.
Okay.
But I don't agree with it. Okay, and nothing in subject to section four of this act, no public employee shall, employer shall prohibit any employee from discussing. Okay, let's say that I'm a legislator of the other party, the administration, okay? And I come to that legislator and say, look at what they're doing. And all these policy decisions are being discussed. Nothing's been decided yet. They're all on the table, and they've got all these options. And then that legislator holds a press conference and pounds the hell out of the administration for all these cockamamie, bizarre kinds of things that are being considered as policy options. They're all on the wall. And I do this repeatedly. Am I protected? In other words, I'm doing my best to undermine the administration, the department that I work for, and I'm a willing accomplice to a legislator who has a political interest in the continuing and perpetual embarrassment of the administration. And between us, we decide that every time I get something that's going to be even the slightest bit embarrassing or, in fact, can be used against the administration, that I'm going to see to it that you ask me to cough it up, and I will. And then you hold a press conference and lambaste the administration. So every time the administration turns around, all of its internal memoranda and discussion papers and everything else are in the public print, and they're getting the heck beat out.
Mr. Chairman?
What do we do to fire that fifth columnist and that saboteur in the administration?
Mr. Chairman, there's a couple things that would restrict.
I'm the governor, and I want to fire that person.
There's a couple provisions of the bill that would restrict that kind of abuse, although it could still occur.
Yeah.
First of all, in section 4, page 2, there is nothing to prohibit the supervisor or appointing authority from requiring that an employee inform the supervisor or appointing authority as to official legislative requests for information to the agency or the substance of testimony made or to be made by the employee to legislators on behalf of the agency or subdivision. So if the employer received a request from me to find out what's going on in the development of policy in the city of Portland, they may be required to report that to inform their supervisor.
Okay.
Second,
the problem is that may be all well and good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then they say, okay, my supervisor comes and said, well, have you disclosed all this? And say, yep, sure did. I did all that.
There's a second
provision. I'm protected under sub 3 from you retaliating against me because I did that because I was requested this legislator.
Well, there's another provision, Mr. Chairman, and that is, nothing in this act is intended to authorize an employee to disclose information required to be kept confidential.
That?
That's on line 29 and 30 of page 2. Required to be kept confidential under state law, rule, or regulation.
State or federal law, rule, or regulation.
Now,
What if it isn't confidential? Because most of
if it's
isn't.
Not confidential, then it's public record, and it could be accessed anyway into the public record law.
Okay, but it's working documents and stuff that's being under consideration that doesn't represent policy yet.
My understanding is there are rules in agencies that restrict release of uncompleted policy documents.
Internal memoranda.
Internal
and
memoranda,
sort of things,
yeah.
Which are not subject.
Which are not subject. In an agency, there's nothing here to prevent an agency from adopting a rule to that effect. So the person who is contacted, I would suggest to add further assurance as to what we're intending that we insert on line 24 of page 1, prohibit any employee from discussing, comma, in response to an official request, comma, either specifically or generally, with any member of the Legislative Assembly, etc. So we're clear that we're talking about a legislator acting in their official capacity.
Yeah. What I'm interested in is and I'll be very honest with you, I'm okay on the bill. The thing is that we invite where you've got 40-some thousand public employees working for the state, not all of whom like the present administration, and the same is true under the previous administration, and it's going to happen every time you have a change in administration, and you have people who are in, who are career, civil service, who are engaged directly in all kinds of policy matters, who are not exempt. There's somebody who can say, okay, change administration, you know, put your resignation on the desk, who may spend, you know, make a hobby out of making sure that nothing occurs under this new administration.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think if we allow the executive or any agency to prohibit communication with the legislator, we're taking the opposite extreme. We're inviting abuse in the opposite direction.
So
I'd like to use an example as to why I think the statute is necessary. In my recent experience, the Employment Division was experiencing this kind of problem. Employees were told in the Employment Division not to communicate with the legislature recently by the outgoing director and by his staff. In fact, at the big meeting in Portland, the big training session, it was reported to me that the director had told the assembled employees of the Employment Division not to talk to the legislature. Now, how can we find out within the scope of our official duties what's going on in the various divisions and agencies if the divisions and agencies, the employees of those agencies, have been forbidden to communicate with us?
Absolutely.
Well, we can find out from one source, the company source.
Right. Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying that as far as the malfeasance, misfeasance, nonfeasance, and all the rest of that, we want them to be able to initiate that, okay? So we understand that that is true. And what I'm just suggesting that your language says prohibit any employee, whether it be a comma, at the request of, what's your language say?
In response to an official request.
Request, comma, from discussing.
Okay,
that would be fine.
The intent to be that it should only be in pursuit of our duties. I cited the Mason's rules earlier that apply to this, to the privilege of legislature to investigate and to obtain information about the programs under our authority. Mason's is pretty explicit about it. We have this authority. We have this authority. We might also want to cite, in response to an official request, as provided by the governing rules of the Legislative Assembly, to cite Mason's, which further defines what the purpose of any request, any investigation should be. That would simply be another note that investigations are only to be in pursuit of good laws. That's what Mason's provides.
Sort of gives a rule of procedure then, a sort of a statutory.
I don't think we're prepared. I wouldn't do that. I think we've got the power under our rules to assert that. I'd rather than trying to ever test that, I think we ought to just simply continue to assert.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, generally, I think we should err on the side of sunshine than on the side of,
absolutely,
of cover.
Absolutely.
That's what this bill does. It errs. It attempts to be reasonable, yet if it errs on the side of sunshine.
I understand that. I just think that that as long as we understand that in Section 3, the first A and B on lines 27 and 28, we're talking about folk who are responding to an official request by a legislator, legislative committee, et cetera.
That's right. And it can only
be.
And
we go out seeking the information. And this is not, I'm not interested in having situation where we end up I think at some point you ought to be able to say to someone, gosh, if you're that disgruntled that you're spending overtime trying to undermine what's being done here and not letting us carry out our business or ever make a decision without having all of our internal memoranda and everything else be disclosed to the public, you're fired. And that's what I want to make sure we're. You can't manage a government if you never can come to a conclusion. We've got people spending all their time trying to shoot you in the foot, so.
I have a couple of questions, Mr. Chair. Back on section 5, sub 2, I think it's a question I asked before, at least I have a note to myself about it. This is the section that says, when an employee reasonably believes that a person receiving services from the state is subject to a felony warrant for arrest, he shall notify the supervisor or some other appropriate person. What if he doesn't? What sanction is there? Is there a sanction in here?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
If that is, under that section, if the agency, if we change that to shall, first of all, assume that.
It is shall.
It's shall.
Let's see, where are we?
Line 42, page 2.
Line 42.
Employees shall promptly and without delay.
Without delay, notify the employee's immediate supervisor or person designated by the agency by rule to receive such notice. There's no penalty in here because an unfair employment practice, by definition, can't be applied against the employee. However, the employee could be sanctioned in other ways. In his personnel record or her personnel record, receive a reprimand, et cetera, because they would be violating the statutory requirement. And they would simply get into trouble in other ways. But
end up with a very poor evaluation and getting put on probation and picking up on charges and eventually
Losing the job?
The union and management fight forever and you put them out on the street and they appeal. And
so I don't think we need a specific penalty for the employee if they don't do it promptly, but trust to the discipline process internal to the organization.
A couple of other questions up on line 31, well, sub 5 of section 4, which is between 31 and 35. Restrict, that is, this act is not intended to restrict or preclude disciplinary action against an employer if the information disclosed by the employee is known by the employee to be false. Should we say is known or should be known?
We could say is known by the employee to be false or for which the employee does not have reasonable grounds, because we use the reasonable grounds language. Let's see, up above.
Well,
reasonably believes. That's the language we use up in line 2. That the employee reasonably believes.
I like known.
You don't think the reckless disregard language would encompass?
Where is that?
Line 33.
Employee discloses the information with reckless disregard for its truth or falsity. The information disclosed relates to the employee's own violations of management.
Might encompass reasonable that.
But we might be specific simply to give more clarity and say if the employee does not have grounds to reasonably believe or knows that it's false.
Why not just is or should be known by the employee to be false?
Does should be known equal reasonably believes?
I think essentially.
Known indicates a level of assurance well above reasonably believed.
Well, I've got a further amendment. I'm going to try and suggest to the committee here in a little bit, and I would go for the higher test because one of the things I'm going to suggest is we give a private right of action against the employee who violates this on behalf of any person wronged by the employee.
Yeah, and I was wondering about that too, whether we shouldn't.
I think that's
either grant it or explicitly provide there's no constraint against it.
I think you already have that. You're talking about the aggrieved third party comes in?
Yeah.
Well, if you accuse them of a crime, or being a criminal, and they aren't, that's defamation. You don't have to worry.
Yeah, but I think we should make it clear that there's no constraint against that right of action intended by this act.
Yeah. What is it we've got over here? We've got
this is a totally different issue. The issue being, are you subject to reprimand by an employer? Not, are you subject to a third-party action for defamation?
Okay.
I think both being related. Okay, well, we can get some boilerplate to make sure that we, because I want to make, I'm sure we've got, if I've got the common law right to come after him for defamation and libel or whatever, we want to make sure that we say that. But concomitantly, I also want to get on there the ability of the employee to come back against the employer for violation of the employee's rights under this thing.
Aren't there penalties for all that somewhere in there?
Existing reference.
Reinstatement and the usual reinstatement back pay. Well, what I want to do is get in their pocket. You know me.
Something similar to Citadel 291.
Some were the worst than others, Bob.
That's true.
Using it to that. Something similar to what we did in 291. So if there's a making an unlawful employment practice.
Nothing in this act is intended to limit any private right of action that either an employee or an employer may have under existing law. Period.
Would that do it?
For the person wronged by disclosure about the crime.
You didn't mean to say that.
Huh? No. I think what he said is good enough.
Nothing in this act is intended to restrict any private action which any person might have.
Would that allow just
existing law?
Mm-hmm. Court action?
Yeah.
So I file a tort claim against my employer.
You got the right. This act
is you got the same stuff that you have. This makes it unlawful to terminate somebody.
Yeah, or
for this reason, you know, for the whistleblower thing.
What do I get?
So then you jump right into wrongful discharge. You know, that tort of wrongful discharge, which is this umbrella deal for when you terminate people when you didn't have the legal grounds to do so.
What if it's not actually discharge, but rather no promotion or other, you know, penalization somehow?
Either you've got the right or you don't have the right under existing law.
Is tort action limited to actual discharge?
No, no.
Or can
well, the wrongful discharge is.
Yes, yeah. So you'd have to have
that statute. Well, what do I do? What rights have I got? If I go and blow the whistle on something and I'm right and it turns out that there is just, you know, just misfeasance. People are just, they're just lousy managers and they've been just letting the public's money run down the drain and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a terrible calamity. And I blow the whistle on that. And it all gets corrected, and I'm a hero, except that I find myself frozen and I'm not going to move and I'm out counting pencils someplace in the warehouse. How do I take action against these folks and make them...
For something other than just getting your job back.
That's right. Where they just say, oh, okay, you want your job? Sure, you can have a job. We'll pay you. No reduction in benefits now. You report to the warehouse out there, and we want you to count paper, not just reams of paper, the sheets and the reams, and report to us how many sheets in each ream. If you're that good at making sure we're not getting cheated, we want to make sure we're getting every sheet and every ream.
Don't we have, there's a retaliation provision in here somewhere.
Yeah, retaliation is one of the things.
Where is that found?
Okay. It'll be page one.
All right, then I come back after him for retaliation. Say, oh, okay, we'll bring you back to the central office.
See, discrimination, dismissal, demotion, suspension, transfer, reassignment, supervisory reprimand, warning of possible dismissal, or withholding of work, whether or not the action... Oh, we left out retaliation.
Well, I think that's encompassed,
isn't it? Includes, but is not limited to...
Well, these are the types of retaliation.
They're all a type of retaliation.
Where then is the operative language that says what happens if you are guilty of disciplinary action?
You, under Section 8, page 3, new lines 34, A, B, and C.
Unlawful employment practice.
You might want to specify.
Employer to discharge, demote, suspend, or in any manner discriminate. Then we go back to the definition.
Well, that's existing
current law.
Now, that's current law for private employers.
Okay, B.
And
or
B, is,
B yeah. A public employer is defined in Section 2 of this 1988 to violate Section 3 to 5 and 7 of this 1988. Okay, so it's an unlawful employment practice. I then go over and say, okay, an unlawful employment practice,
what can I do to them then?
You can get reinstatement or back pay, which doesn't help you if you haven't actually been terminated.
Right.
So if you wanted to add remedies like you had under Senate Bill 291, you would need to add something additional.
Okay, because that's what I did. The kind of petty harassment that you know is going to run from one of these cases where you've got nonfeasance or malfeasance, the kind of petty harassment that's going to run following that, they're going to send the person to Coventry. Now, that's the first thing that happens. They're going to, you know, you're just going to, your life's going to be hell. That's just the name of that tune. The question is when the person says, okay, I've had enough of that, I'm being, the disciplinary action that's being taken, this harassment and retaliation that's being taken, it's got to be addressed. I'm going to take them to court. And if I've never been dismissed and I've never been demoted, I haven't lost any benefits.
Looking at the Section 8, it doesn't say that it's an unlawful employment practice for an employer to discriminate or retaliate against an employee for blowing the whistle as permitted under this act. It doesn't say that anywhere that I read.
Why don't you go ahead and suggest that?
I think that's probably accurate in that you want to repeat something that's in lines 30 through 34. You want to have that repeated to threaten to or to take disciplinary action against a public employee with regard to promotion, compensation, et cetera.
Right.
Yeah, and then
or in regards to Section 3 or 5 and 7, something like that.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure how to say it, but the point is that an employee who acts properly under this act is not to be discriminated or retaliated against.
Right.
Then, okay.
So we need to repeat something. So
including but not limited to. So we say that and then follow it with our examples, which we include but are not limiting ourselves to.
Well, you might just want to amend this 659035 sub 1 so that it picks up this act.
Yeah.
Okay.
As well as ORS Chapter 441 and 443.
That's fine with me, and that would be clearer.
Yep.
Bullet there. Okay.
So then if you've got that built in, you could then, I assume, you could sue some. Can you sue somebody in a private right of action for a unlawful employment practice for damages arising from an unlawful employment practice? I would think you probably could.
I never heard of it done.
You're limited by what the statutory reference is, and the statutory reference for 659035 is reinstatement, back pay, equitable relief, unless you reference another specific subsection. And that's what we ended up doing in Senate Bill 291 with unlawful employment practice for sex discrimination, race discrimination.
Now, we could just take that language and lift it as boilerplate and insert it here. So we use the language we hammered out with that one.
Put them in front of a judge and put in a limit of 25,000 punitive and let the rest run to the general fund and et cetera.
I'm not sure you'd want the rest to run to the general fund. Because you've got one public employer paying the general fund.
No, just cap it at 25 and let it go.
Sort of taken off in a whole new direction 25. Here.
Yeah. Well, there's two ways. See, the two concerns I've had about this bill. The first one is you get somebody who is a malcontent, and they use this under the cover of this law to undermine the proper and day-to-day administration of the government.
Right.
A malcontent, a fifth columnist, a saboteur.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we got to make sure that we can address that. At the same time, I want to make sure that we've got an effective stick in the hands or a shield, some defense for the person who actually blows the whistle on malfeasance, nonfeasance, whether if not criminal, it borders on criminality, the kind of stupidity that's going on, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that the kind of harassment and retaliation that's going to come, for which there is psychic damage and the kind of stress and ulcers the result, lack of sleep and all the rest of it, from just being, you know, ding, 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 ding for the rest of your natural life as you're trying to get to the gold watch and the pension.
Mm-hmm.
And so at some point, being able to come back and say, hey, whoa on all that. I've had it. I'm taking you to court. Because all of this arises out of this incident. I've got no remedy against you. I've got a statute that says you're not supposed to do this, but I got no way to enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And you got to get them in front of a judge that says, hey, what you did stinks. I've heard the evidence. These guys made a crappy case. You've been you've been harassing this person unmercifully as a result of him doing what this law required, pay the man and stop doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only effective way I see it. Otherwise, you, for all I know, you might get recovery. You probably couldn't even get recovery of your attorney fees if you haven't been demoted or lost any income under the unlawful employment practice.
Isn't there, Mr. Chairman, a broad limitation on punitive damages to public agencies?
Yes.
Yes.
So we don't need to cite that.
You need to.
In other words, it goes up to the lid and that's it. You don't go over that.
Yeah, what's the lid? 2,500?
2,500,
I think.
Well, under the torts claims, or the last session you passed the limit on liability for public bodies, mm-hmm. and that's $100,000 for one single incident. But it also prohibits award of punitive damages, as I read it. So you would have to exempt
yourself
from that.
Those are compensatory damages?
$100,000 general and special, that's compensatory.
Well,
and then prohibits any punitive.
Well, we might have a hard time rocking that boat.
Well, could I go after them for what falls under the general special damages? Is that also recovery, or is there pain and suffering? And
uh-huh. It says for all claims. So that would mean some kind of loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to prove it.
Either in terms of people or finance to deal with the situation, then they come back to us and we have a reserve fund to help them out. We also have access to a Secretary of Labor's discretionary grant fund. If there's not enough money in the state to deal with the dislocation, then we can go to the feds. We have used that one in several places around the state in the last few years. The most current is the Caterpillar closure out here at Dallas. So we are on track to get this thing in place by the 1st of July, and we'll be able to provide the appropriate reports to you shortly after the end of our program year next summer.
Okay.
Thank
you, Chair. Senator Gretzky.
How does this dovetail in with the Emergency Economic Assistance Act? Are you familiar with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gretzky, the 2304 originally referred to that. We took a real careful look at it and decided that given the new provisions of EDWA, that we could frankly probably move faster and marshal the same resources without invoking the older legislation. We are going to be tied in, by way of the Economic Development Department with all the resources there. We're bringing all the job training resources. The Employment Division is coming in with all of their resources. So our feeling at this point, given the fact that there has been 4 or 5 years now of local response to dislocations by our private industry councils, the building on that experience with the additional resources that we can now bring to bear. We think we've got everybody tied into this that could be a significant player.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
I just, 1981 came through for the first time in the legislature to lobbying for the plant closure bill. Might remember that one. And now we find it brought before us as a result of an act of Congress. And I guess that demonstrates it's been a long time since 1981. But, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask why specifically was the requirement that EDD determine cause and consequence of plant closure deleted? Was that a fiscal decision? Was it because it would cost a lot of money to make that determination? The original bill required that, and the amended bill deletes that particular requirement.
That's the same question you asked, isn't it, Senator Gransky? Approximately?
So it's a reference to the state law.
But what was the factor, what was the reason for the decision?
Yeah, why don't you run and buy that answer again?
Or was I just not listening?
Well, Senator Hill, the determining the cause and the consequence of a closure will be a part of our assessment of the situation. We're looking, for example, at the possibility of a great number of wood products closures coming up here real soon, and that assessment of why these things are happening has to be a part of our initial assessment of an individual situation, partially to see if there's anything systemic that needs to be dealt with. The pieces of the original bill that were deleted were simply things that we either saw as redundant with what was required of us in the federal legislation, or I'm looking at the word economic status in section 6 of the early version, simply that in that sense the determining the economic status of an employer who is out of business would be difficult, plus there's quite a bit of expense, we suspect, in following up on economic status of employers, even if they do stay in business to some extent. But again, our intent was with the things we took out, simply if we felt they were simply restating what we were already forced to do with federal legislation, we were just looking for simplicity.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
I see nothing wrong with the bill.
Neither do I. Passed 58 to zip.
And
in the House. One was absent and one was excused.
Are we in work session?
Well, anybody else want to appear on House Bill 2304? Hearing none, we'll close the hearing on that, Senator Hill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill 2304A in gross to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Heard the motion. Any discussion? Hearing none, call the roll.
Senator Gransky?
Aye.
Senator Hill?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Chair Caron?
Aye.
Motion is adopted. Okay, let's get on to the next one, 2036. Mr. Barr, thank you for your patience. This one's a little more complicated. At least on the surface.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is George Barr. I'm the manager of the Personnel Systems section in the Personnel and Labor Relations Division of the Executive Department. House Bill 2036 was submitted by the Executive Department to try and improve opportunities for transfer between agencies for current employees and also to try and improve reemployment opportunities for former employees. It would do this by giving state agencies the option of requiring trial service periods for transfers or reemployments. Currently, the law authorizes trial service only in two situations, on initial appointment to state service or on promotion to a higher level classification. The majority of employees who are interested in transfers or ex-employees seeking reemployment have regular status. They have successfully completed either the initial trial service period with the state or a promotional trial service period. When they contact an agency for a transfer or a reemployment, the agency must hire them at regular status or not hire them at all. Unless the agency is knowledgeable about the individual's job skills and previous job performance, the agency is reluctant to hire the individual without a trial service or probationary period, and most, we have found, will not do so. We don't believe the requirement for a new trial service period on either the transfer or reemployment would deter employees from wanting transfers or reemployments. We believe most employees feel confident enough about their abilities that they would willingly accept a trial service period in order to obtain a transfer or to obtain a reemployment. The amendments made by the House in the A and Growth version retain the employee status when transferring back to their former agency within 1 year, or when being reemployed back to their former agency within 1 year. And since these individuals are known to those agencies, we see no problem in excluding them from the option for a trial service in those situations. I would like to emphasize that this bill does not mandate a trial service period. It provides the option for the agency to require one. It only applies to transfers between agencies, not to transfers within a same agency. Yeah. And it only applies to the classified, unrepresented, and management service position, not to positions that are under collective bargaining agreements.
Questions?
Senator Hill.
I wasn't aware that it was the current situation that an employee who transfers, it may not be put on trial service. So the current situation is an employee who transfers is not allowed to be put on trial service.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hill, that's correct.
Is that true when an employee transfers from one position to another within an agency as well as between agencies?
Yes, it is.
I'll be darned.
If the employee already has attained regular status, then the agency must accept regular status on the new position.
And this is trial service the same thing as probationary service?
Yes, it is, Senator.
So that, as I understand it, this is for management service and unrepresented classified. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So I'm management service, and I'm in a department, and I see another job over there that piques my interest, and I want to go over there. And the another division says, well, before we take a flyer on you, we bring you over here, and you got regular status, and we've got you forever. We don't know whether you're compatible. We want to put you on trial service, which is 6 months, right? They take a look at me, and then at 6 months, they decide, okay, we're glad we had the trial service here because we've come to the conclusion that we don't want you. Does that person then fall through the rabbit hole and disappears from state service? Do they go back to their other job? What happens to them? They've shown the great... this way to the great egress, and they find themselves out of the mall in front of their car.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned management service. For management service employees, if the individual does not successfully complete the trial service, is removed during trial service, and they previously held classified job, then they have the right to be restored back to a position in their former class and agency.
Okay.
It's a guaranteed restoration.
That's
right.
A bumping right.
Oh,
is that
they
a bump?
Also, yes, that's right.
So you can bump into some place. Well, that'd be a welcome arrival, wouldn't it? Okay. Is there ever a time when these people find themselves shown the great egress and you're out the door? I mean, where you don't have a previous classified position, you came in as management service, you're in management service, you move over to someplace else, trial service, and then you're gone.
In that situation, Mr. Chair, it's up to the agency as to whether they wish to find another position for the individual.
Otherwise, they're out of luck.
Otherwise, they're out of luck.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm not going to break my heart, but that's all right.
Those same people... those same people could have been discharged by the place from which they're moving, could they not? In other words, these are non-civil service employees we're talking about now, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shoemaker, yes, they are.
Yes, they are civil service employees?
Yes, they are.
Well, then, so then they're working for Agency A, and Agency A can't get rid of them.
Except for cause.
Except for cause. So what you commonly do then is to try to find some other place for them to go. So then you go to this other place, and that other place then has a trial period, right?
Under this bill.
And if they don't cut it, that other place, the trial period, then they're out. So it's a way of,
Not particularly. It isn't aimed that way. It's actually to permit the greater freedom and movement from agency to agency,
yeah.
And to take a flyer on somebody. In other words, somebody comes in.
I guess I'm wondering why the management service people wouldn't have the same bump rights as the classified unrepresented people would have if they don't cut it during the trial period. In other words, they too can go back and with the same rights to be protected except for discharge for cause. Am I missing something here?
No, Senator Shoemaker, if the management service individual held former classified service, then they would have the right back.
Yeah, but we're talking about when they don't.
But when they don't, then our rules do not give them the restoration right to a management service position.
What happens to those people now? They hold a management position, it's not a classified management position, so they're not, it's just a management position, and they're not cutting it where they are. What happens to them now?
If normally, I believe, in situations where an individual would transfer from one agency to another.
No, I think the question is this. Let me try the question. Let's say we've got somebody who's in place. He's not looking for a transfer. He's in place. He's in management. Is management divided between those that are exempt and others that have some vested right in their position?
That's right.
Okay. Now, that may be part of the confusion. Yeah. How many folks, now if I'm in a management position, I'm in, and does this cover people, well, let's take the people that are exempt. Okay, that'd be upper management, right?
That's right.
They're exempt from the civil service rules, right? They can be fired the same as people in private industry can be fired.
That's correct, Senator.
Okay, so giving them a trial period doesn't make any difference.
No problem with that.
Okay. The next class of people we're talking about, these people are, what, career management service. Is that right?
That's right.
They're outside of a bargaining unit. They're not political appointees. They are career management folk. Now, if one of those people came in to an appointment to management service and went on a trial period to another management position and had no previous classified service, they didn't come through the ranks, they came in at that point, moved over in a trial service, didn't cut on the trial service. They have no vested. Do they have a vested right back to their old position, or do they drop?
They have no vested right currently, okay. And this is the way the law has been interpreted, I believe, okay. For many years, when management service was first created, you know, several years ago. I think that's the way it's been interpreted.
Could they be fired then, without cause by their present position? In other words, as things stand right now, these people we're talking about, if they're not working out, they can be discharged, and that's it? You don't have to go to a hearing and all that other
Mr.
process?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shoemaker, I'm not knowledgeable enough really to respond to the disciplinary.
I guess what I want to be sure of is that we're not providing a means here to get rid of somebody who you can't now get rid of. In other words, I don't want it to be used for that. Now, if you can assure me that it doesn't do that, then I'm a lot more comfortable.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Shoemaker, the idea here is to not do that at all, but to create more opportunities.
And I'm all for that. That's
it's up to the
great.
Employee, if a managed service employee wishes to transfer, and the agency says, we'll only transfer you if you will, you know, agree to a new trial service period. The employee makes a decision at that point, either accept it or not, knowing that if they did not have prior classified service, they might be out the door if they aren't successful.
Okay.
If they feel they aren't, they can't handle a job, then they would probably decline it and not accept the transfer.
Okay. Well, this transfer then has to be at the request of the employee, is that right?
Yeah.
Is that correct? Is that so provided in here somewhere, or is that provided within the rules?
It's a method of change within our personnel rules and
under those rules, the employee has to request it or at least consent to it.
That's correct, Shoemaker. That's correct.
It can be as yeah.
It's not. There's no mandatory transfer between agencies.
Boy, have we got a deal for you.
You're going over to the warehouse, and you're going to count paper.
And you get a trial period.
And you get a trial period. And if you want, we can disclose the results of the trial period now, or you can wait 6 months. Okay.
I have another question.
Well, let me interject. We understand that this is primarily situations where someone wishes to bid, in effect, if I think in terms of bargaining, you're going to bid on a job out over here, and it's more likely to occur when that receiving agency, taking that employee, has the ability to say, okay, but I want a trial period. They're more likely to do that. That's create more flexibility and, in fact, probably get people who may have become jaded, tired, or maybe approaching burnout in their position, want a new career change and a new challenge and go over and do something else and learn something new and exciting. Not about the size of it.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And also, there's spouses, for example, who wish to move with their spouse to another location, and they would like to achieve a transfer in a new location.
Okay. I interject. Senator Shermer.
Yeah. Did I hear you testify earlier that you were not requiring this trial period for those employees who return to their former agency? After the absence of more than 1 year, either by transfer or by reemployment. The reason I ask that is that I thought that's what I heard you say, but as I read the Say and Gross bill, they are given the trial period, and so I'm just confused on that point.
Okay, Senator Shoemaker, when we first submitted the bill, we had the bill was worded that there would be a trial service in all transfers between agencies and all reemployments. In the discussion on the House side, there was concern about an employee who maybe separates and within 2 years wants to be reemployed, or within 1 year wants to be reemployed back to the same agency. They felt that within 1 year, nothing probably has changed that much. The agency is very familiar with the employee's work. Therefore, that employee should be able to be reemployed
so
with regular status.
So it's the more than
the
1 year. More
after
than 1 year.
After the first year,
okay, I get it.
Then they had the option of trial service.
I get it. Okay, thank you. That clarifies that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hill, are you okay on this thing?
Yeah. I feel okay upon the changes, but I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that this amends a section of the law that we're also amending in 1051. Annette and I were just discussing, we run into the problem of whichever bill is signed by the governor last rules. What we could do, Mr. Chairman, is the easiest thing to do and to save paperwork on the part of the Assembly is to simply fold this bill into the otherwise excellent language of 1051 and further improve the measure. And that would assure, provide a level of assurance that individuals transferred according to this new language would be protected according to the language of 1051 against transfer as a reprisal.
No, this does not permit an ordered transfer, does it? I can't order.
We established that.
No, that takes the approval of the appointing authorities of the gaining agency.
Okay.
One agency cannot presently transfer an individual to a different agency unless the other appointing authority is willing to accept.
Yeah, what I'm interested in is the employee. If my employer gets together with the other agency over there and they decide between themselves that, yes, I'm going to be transferred, but that's not a transfer I asked for, can that be accomplished?
Not unless the employee agrees to it.
Fine, as long as we understand that.
then I think we're okay. I'd rather just have the thing stand on its own, the question of whether we want to, the conflict of amendments are a matter of housekeeping. If it's the, is it the same section 240, 240, 316?
316.
We delete this.
It's section 10, and we delete section 5, subsection 5 in
which
this
is,
section.
Yeah, well, that'll be changed.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It depends.
Well, unless we reach
we
the governor's...
We do need conflict amendments.
We pass this out, it'll reach the governor's desk, and we'll, they'll have to... If 1051 comes behind it and simply repeals that existing law, and this bill doesn't amend that section, then you have no conflict. It'll just be deleted, and then there's no... This only adds a new material on the front, on subsection 1. Subsection 5 is going to be deleted and have no impact, there's no conflict. So, I understand it. Anybody testify against this thing over there? Obviously, there's nobody here to tell us what our...
Mr. Chair, could I request that in the staff measure summary that we take to the floor that it make it clear that this can only happen to
the employee.
That's
request.
Sure to raise questions in people's minds.
All right. We'll close the hearing on 2036, and Chair, accept the motion.
So moved. Move the bill.
Go ahead. Need somebody to carry some bills. Move the bills, you carry the bills. Senator Shoemaker moves House Bill 2036 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, not clerk, call a roll.
Senator Grinsky? Senator Hill?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Chair Karen?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, I just asked that Annette check with counsel and see how it would be resolved as to how these two bills would affect that one section.
Okay.
Goes first.
No problem.
There's a typo, yeah.
No problem.
Yeah.
Oh, that's okay. Just count it absent when the gavel drops. Well, we're...
Okay.
Hey, it's daylight savings. We're here. Okay. Mr. Lent. And I see your treasurer cohort back there who's actually requested this little Hummer. We're going to hear from him. Long as he buttons his coat.
Chairman, this doesn't have anything to do with divestiture, does it?
No. Bite your tongue.
Different week. Different week. Okay.
Good bill should pass. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Lent. I'm the tax manager for the Employment Division. I'm here to say that we have no problem with the bill, as we currently do the same type of administration of the local government employer benefit trust fund that we would. We do it now through a contractual agreement with the Treasurer's Department. This would just make it a legal requirement that we do it.
And I assume State Treasurer, by virtue of the fact that you requested it, wish to withdraw from this interagency hocus pocus?
For the record, I'm Steve Smith, Deputy State Treasurer, and the good bill should pass.
Great. So as I understand it, these folks send it up to you. You have to then account for it, and you turn around and give it to them, and then they do what they're going to do, and you just want to get out of the middle.
That's great. It saves 3 days in processing checks to get them to the local level.
And
no doubt saves money.
Saves money.
Yes.
Earns interest.
Yes.
You end up earning more as a result of it? Or do we just reduce administrative costs?
Mr. Chair, on our side, it reduces administrative costs and gets the money to the local entity in a quicker manner. Just
okay.
Just a bureaucratic change is all.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
How does the money flow now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hill, further, the way that in the past this bill, or we were asked, and we're currently not operating this way, but if a warrant or a check was asked for from the executive department, we were asked to prepare an invoice, and we request the executive department to prepare a warrant, and a warrant is received, the Treasury sends a copy to the Employment Division and forwards a warrant to the local government, and we're just being taken out of the loop. So that it can speed up the process.
Yeah.
The check and balances are still in the process. We're an unneeded step.
Okay. And what was the vote over there?
58-0.
Another Hummer. Zip that thing through. All right. We'll close the hearing on 2111. And is there a motion?
I'll move the bill.
Senator Shoemaker.
We'll carry two as one.
House Bill 2111. Well, these are mumblers. You just got their mumbler on there. Boom. The floor with due pass recommendation. Clerk, call roll.
Senator Hill?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Sheriff Heron?
Aye. And we're out of here.
We go home now?
Yeah, I will ask, in fact, I've asked Annette to send a letter to the Judiciary Chair. If we're going to be start at 5, I mean, if the session starts at 5, I'd like to start at 3 on Wednesday, or as close to as I possibly can.
Okay. Okay.
All right, thank you. We're adjourned.
The name of your committee, are you on?
Oh, my what?
In before then?
Oh, yeah.